As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome back to the latest edition of The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined as always by my colleague Stuart Mandel. We are taping Monday morning. It's been a crazy week in college football. It's been a crazy week all around. We're going to be joined, Stu, by our man on all things Iowa, Scott Docterman, who's had some really interesting reporting as he has followed a very big story that has developed around Kirk Ferentz's program there. We will get into the details in a little bit, but it's not just Iowa that has really been in the focus of what we feel like is a cultural shift that is taking place right now in the country, and it's impacted in football as well. It's at some other programs also are in the spotlight. One of them is Utah.
Right. I mean, like you said, a tremendous cultural shift going on right now in our whole country, and I think it has empowered certainly former college football players to speak out about instances where they encountered racism while they were playing college football. And you know, you don't hear that from current players because they fear the repercussions. Former players obviously feel a little bit freer to speak out. Utah, I mean, that's a really troubling situation. Morgan Scali, star player there, longtime DC now, who actually was a Broyles finalist last year. You know, first there was a text that surfaced of him using the N-word, and he was suspended. But Chris Kamrani, who's our excellent Utah writer, talked to a bunch of former players. Really interesting, the spectrum of responses he got, where some black players who played there say they're stunned by that, and they can't believe it. They don't believe he's a racist. And then others saying, yeah, that didn't surprise me all that much. You know, he didn't necessarily say that, but we overheard him, you know, do this or this. And, you know, we just think he's ignorant. So, you know, Utah now investigating him. You know, obviously at Clemson last week, it came out that Danny Pierman, their special teams coordinator, I think since Dabo got there or took over as head coach, used the N-word at practice a few years ago. He put out a statement apologizing for it. We've not heard from Dabo at all since that happened, and that is leading to its own round of criticism. The Iowa story, though, just fascinates me. I mean, this is a program that you rarely hear any controversy out of, and Kirk Ferentz has been the coach for two decades. And starting on Friday night, just player after player after player, you know, I think over 40 of them by now, have spoken out about their experiences there. And the strength coach, Chris Doyle, who's the highest paid strength coach in the country, at the center of a lot of those accusations. And so I think it's a complicated story. It's not quite as straightforward or simple to you know, sum up as maybe Danny Pierman in this one incident a few years ago. So we want to bring on Scott. He's our excellent Iowa reporter, and I think he's going to help really explain and put into context what's going on there right now. We are pleased to be joined now by The Athletic's Iowa writer, Scott Docterman, who's done a tremendous job reporting on and keeping everybody up to date on a very explosive situation going on around that program, one that really seemingly came out of nowhere and escalated tremendously in the span of about 48 hours. Scott, for those who haven't been following this, give us just a little bit of a chronology of how, you know, how things went from, you know, kind of the same quiet, mostly quiet atmosphere around Iowa football under Kirk Ferentz to where we are now.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's been a wild week. It's been a wild, certainly, weekend. And I think really where this kind of all started was maybe close to 10 days ago with some of the protests around George Floyd's murder, or alleged murder by a police officer in Minneapolis, that a lot of the players started to get on Kirk a little bit about why he hadn't released a statement. And Kirk, a week from Saturday ago, sent them all a voicemail saying, yes, I want to release a statement, but I do want to talk to you first and, you know, and get your thoughts and also relay mine. And then last Monday, he did that. And in a kind of an eloquent speech about race and how he's a 64-year-old white coach, and he's not aware of what it's like to live in their world and being in their shoes. And it was widely praised by his players, both black and white, and those who came before him, before the current players. Well, on Wednesday, Kirk held a news conference, and the subject of kneeling came up. And 4 years ago, in 2016, when Colin Kaepernick first took a knee, there were several Iowa players who wanted to do that, and Kirk basically forbid it. And that became kind of an underlying issue. Players played through it, but they weren't happy about it. The ones who weren't. Well, when he said the other day that it's going to be up, he'd like for the players to either do one or the other, stand at attention or kneel, you know, to kind of show what he thinks or thought was kind of an evolving position. One of his former players, James Daniels, you know, now offensive lineman with the Chicago Bears, you know, said, you know, if the team collectively decides to kneel, this will bring about a cultural change for both Iowa football and the state of Iowa, which I believe is long overdue. And as you can imagine, because we're in such a polarized environment and hypercharged, you know, his tweet was met with both positive and opposition from Iowa fans and fans in general. And so it kind of started to build off of that. Then Friday night, at right around 7 o'clock, James Daniels tweeted about the culture at Iowa. And this was, this really turned off to be an explosive environment. He said there were too many racial disparities in the Iowa football program. Black players have been treated unfairly for far too long. And it was since tweeted, retweeted, commented by more than 50 Iowa players. I would say 75% of which were, you know, minorities, and all of them seem to have stories to share about their treatment, most of which in the strength and conditioning program with Chris Doyle, some of which with just people in general in Iowa. It is a primarily Caucasian state. But, you know, and then there was some spillover to a couple of the assistant coaches, Brian Ferentz being specific, and also Seth Wallace. And then parents were also involved. So this became kind of a cleansing, if you will, for a lot of people who wanted to get a lot of things off their chest regarding Iowa football and the issues associated with it. And in turn, by Friday night, Kirk Ferentz releases a statement, apparently pretty surprised by all the incidents. And then by Saturday, Chris Doyle was placed on administrative leave. And Kirk Ferentz held a news conference yesterday to kind of try to explain the situation. But Chris Doyle is on a suspension, a paid suspension. But from what I'm gathering, it's unlikely that he will return as that strength coach.
Scott, I, you know, in the story, and I encourage people, if they haven't followed this closely, to read the story, especially that went up on Monday, because it really gives some full context. And as you said in Spillover, there's, you know, what's happened, and I followed along on social media in real time with some of these comments that have been retweeted. There is a lot of things that are very, and I saw this in Kirk Ferentz's comments on Sunday on the Zoom call, where he talked about demanding versus demeaning. And that when I heard that, it reminded me of something that I had heard somebody close to the Maryland investigation of DJ Durkin had talked about, in terms of when you get into, when some people say it is a toxic culture, like that's what was the phraseology around Maryland. Now, in the case of this, like one of the things that obviously the issue of race is a hot topic right now, and as it should be, but also there's elements of Jack Kallenberger tells this story about being referred to by one assistant as Simple Jack. And for anyone who saw the movie Tropic Thunder, I think they get that reference. And his story that he tells is really, it's sad. It is heartbreaking. It's not one that gets into the element of race, but it gets into the element of like, how are players being treated there? And then you just see one story after another, as Stu had mentioned earlier. And my question to you is, so many of these stories and so many different voices, and you saw a lot of white players from Iowa also, you know, talk about how bad they felt because they didn't know of some of these things, or maybe didn't feel like they had spoken up. How much do you think right now, Kirk has been there for 20 plus years, that this reflects on him as well, in a way of how come he didn't know some of these things, if it was like the dirty little secret inside the program?
Yeah, that's a great point. It's a good question, because, you know, Kirk Ferentz, as people may know, you know, is the longest tenured head coach in college football. He's had a lot of success, especially at Iowa, 5 top 10s, 8 top 25 finishes, the winningest coach in school history, a lot of success. But I think where a lot of this started was when he was hired in 1999, and Hayden Fry before him was a real player's coach. And he instilled a different type of mindset, a disciplined mindset. And he brought Chris Doyle in, who was recommended by his mentor, Joe Moore, Kirk Ferentz's former high school coach, and his mentor in life, brought in Chris Doyle to help him build this program. And back then, they moved 3 guys to the offensive line, and all 3 became All-Americans on a team where Iowa finished 8-0 in the Big Ten. There was no playoff or the championship game in the Big Ten, so they couldn't play Ohio State, but they were a very good team in 2002. And I think what they saw was the growth that Doyle could do. And they, over the years, that just gradually built a number of players in the NFL. That, you know, in a 3-year period, there were 3 top 10 teams. Doyle instilled this almost military type culture, and everything was, you know, there are signs in the building that says, you know, keep, you know, every, this is our business. Our business is our business. And really just keeping everything inside and to itself, that I think over time, Chris's main, his power structure has grown, and Kirk has kind of lived off that good cop, bad cop, if you will. Chris does a lot of the dirty work. Well, Chris's mindset is different, and it's Kirk is easy to talk to when you get him one-on-one, incredibly intelligent, and Chris is too in his own way. But I think what happened over time was he was given free rein in the strength and conditioning area, and he's now the highest paid strength and conditioning coach in the country at $800,000. And people will say, well, you know, why aren't you winning national titles? Well, let's face it. If Iowa wasn't very good in that area, Iowa would be a lot closer to Purdue than say Michigan. So there's an element of truth in that, but the way that the players were treated over time, the demeaning part of it, it's almost drill sergeant from 50 years ago. And a lot of it's, you know, Iowa's almost one of its mantras is we're not for everybody here. And they try to toughen you up mentally as much as physically. And players who can't hack it, well, they leave, and they almost have a pride factor with that. Well, as we've seen, that there are a lot of players who've become collateral damage, and as I mentioned, Iowa is not exactly the most diverse state in the country, and it has to recruit outside in major metro areas in the Midwest, usually, and a lot of players aren't used to the culture here, but Doyle has kind of forced a certain culture upon them, and a lot of that is, you know, dress in the facility, the way you do things. And some of it is so strict, you know, you just, your jaw kind of drops. But as long as Iowa kind of got the results, everybody kind of looked the other way. But what we've seen now is stories like Jack Kallenberger. And Jack was, you know, his younger brother is a starting offensive lineman at Iowa, Mark. So he actually asked permission of Mark to be able to share his story. But you know, whether it's Doyle kind of demeaning players, I think that's fair. And that has kind of spilled over to some of the assistant coaches. And now with everybody feeling emboldened to use their voice and to speak out, you're seeing a lot of these stories. And at last count, there were more than 50 that have come out, and most of them have been pretty negative, especially with Doyle and a few assistants. So this is a very concerning situation, obviously, for Iowa, and one that they are investigating beyond the athletic department.
The story fascinates me for so many reasons. I mean, you know, you think about over the years since Twitter became a thing, there have been examples around the country of, you know, a player or two players who sounded off about, you know, maybe they transferred or they didn't like their time there and they said something. And it was very easy for the fans to just kind of dismiss it as, oh, that's a couple of disgruntled players. I've never seen something like this where dozens and dozens of former players spoke up, you know, seemingly all at once. And we're talking about, you know, not a DJ Durkin or Tim Beckman, who just wasn't all that respected in the first place, but Kirk Ferentz and Chris Doyle, who, you know, Chris Doyle is the highest paid strength coach in the country, top of his profession. But most of all, I think what's really interesting, Scott, is there are a couple examples, you know, in these tweets of comments that there's just, you know, it's clear cut. Somebody said he was told, you know, go back to the ghetto. Somebody else, go back to the streets. Like, it doesn't, you know, some Brian Ferentz accused of asking somebody, are you going to go rob a liquor store? Like, those are clearly racist, and the average reader reading that can identify that pretty easily. What there are far more of are kind of what you were talking about with the restrictions, where, you know, we talk about the culture of a program, and I'm sure over the years Ferentz has been lauded for the culture of his program. All the while, we didn't realize how much that culture involved restrictions that for a black player are make them feel like it's basically just not okay to be black in that building. Cornrows being outlawed. A player saying that he got called into the coach's office because he has too many tattoos. And maybe these are things that in the 1960s would be totally normal, or even more recently than that. But in today's culture, you know, you're telling black players that they can't do things that you know, other black Americans can do. There's no restrictions on that. No earrings. The one that really floored me, apparently, and Kirk mentioned this on his own media call as like a positive thing. Like, oh, we loosened some restrictions. You know, hoodies are allowed around the building now. That just floored me. Hoodies? Are you serious? How did this stay under wraps for this long? It seems to me, and you maybe you can talk a little bit about the stats you mentioned about how many black players have transferred over the years there, but in today's college football, I just don't understand how that could go on for that long, that he's even able to recruit black players under those conditions.
Yeah, you bring up a lot of good points, and you know, I've mentioned the attrition level quite a bit in some of the stuff I've written. I mean, I think, you know, one area was wide receivers. From 2013 to 2016, Iowa signed 10 freshman wide receivers, and only one ended up, having any kind of impact and lasting through his as a wide receiver throughout his whole career. One other one moved over to defensive back. But the rest of them transferred or retired, And most of them were African-American and they were not from this area. So I think that really speaks to, you know, just how they're not able to fit in. And when you see that, those kind of numbers, and you write about it, and it really is jarring. Yet at that time, then they end up firing the wide receivers coach and bringing in somebody else. And the attrition level goes down. So maybe you think it's the wide receivers coach that's the issue. But overall, you know, it does show with a lot of these issues, just, you know, we knew it was strict. We knew it was tough. A lot of the players had mentioned some of that, but again, it was almost a military environment that, you know, as you talk to them over and over again, it's, you know, whether it's for show, whether they're not really sharing all their details, they really just didn't want to, they didn't say anything negative about it. And then they also saw the success. So in a lot of ways, they figured they would shut their mouths, get through it, get it over with, and then go on to the NFL and have success. And Iowa's NFL numbers really kind of belie where it really fits in the overall recruiting realm. So a lot of players have seen that and they wanted to be a part of that. So they didn't complain. Now others have who've left the program, but you know, how much do you discuss with one to two to even three players a year over a 15-year period about, you know, they were the third string guy. They'd been there for 2 years. Maybe they're from New Jersey or maybe they're from Texas. They didn't get to play. They didn't like the coaches. Well, you know, that happens everywhere. How much validity do you give it to them? And, but I think what you saw the other day and what makes it really different is the level of players who spoke up, not only, you know, celebrity types from Iowa, you know, starters, NFL players, but even very, very respected players. Probably the one that I wouldn't say surprised me the most, but really the one that I was drawn to was a guy named Jordan Lomax. He played for 5 years. He was a team captain. He was an academic All-American. He worked for the University of Iowa Foundation, raising money until last summer, and then took a job with a bank. And, you know, he really felt like he mentioned that there needed to be a culture change in the weight room. And that seemed to be the area. And the majority of the players kind of stayed away from Kirk Ferentz, but they really went after Chris Doyle for that makeup. And, you know, some of the petty things you think about, like, you know, he got kicked out. Jaleel Johnson, I think, tweeted that he got kicked out of the weight room because his shoes were untied or something like that. But I think the things when it comes to cornrows, tattoos, and then the slurs and the racist statements, those are things that we really had not heard except for in a couple things in passing over the years.
Yeah, I mean, real quick before Bruce has a question, but to me, one of the more telling ones was Amani Hooker, who was a star there as recently as, 2 years ago, you know, is in the NFL now. And his quote was, "It would be difficult for black players to walk around the facility and be themselves." And that seems to kind of almost sum up the general theme we're seeing in a lot of those. And like you said, you know, some of the players who tweeted were there for 1 or 2 years and transferred, and you might say, oh, they were disgruntled. But, you know, that's a player who was a star for them and is in the NFL now and carries a lot of weight.
Without a doubt. And, you know, James Daniels was the one who started this. You know, his father played at Ohio State. James was a, you know, a 5-star recruit or 4.5-star recruit that Iowa beat Ohio State and Alabama for, partly because his older brother was a running back there. And he's as intelligent as any player I've ever been around. He wants to go into hospital administration. He came back last year after he left early for the NFL to get his degree. He's getting his MBA now. For him to start this and continue it, I think really shows that, you know, he thinks that this is an important thing to really discuss. And I was told Friday late afternoon, early evening by one parent that be ready, this is coming. So this was fairly coordinated too among them. But this was, you know, to have, you know, James Daniels, as you know, and Amani Hooker and some of the others bring this up, I think was really important to make sure everybody knew that this wasn't just a couple of disgruntled players.
So Scott, as we're talking about it, it is now Monday morning. This has been a couple of days, and there's been Kirk Ferentz has made a couple of comments, more than a couple of comments, but in the face of it, one thing I wanted to ask you about, which, and I'll say this off the top, through our covering games, I've spent a decent amount of time around Iowa's program, and have found Kirk Ferentz to be one of the most engaging, thoughtful head coaches we deal with, and that's across the board. I mean, and I, you know, I remember you did a story probably 18 months ago, maybe it's not that long ago, about him. And, you know, again, I just, there's, to me, there's a little bit of a disconnect compare, you know, seeing what I'm seeing. And then just from my own personal experiences, just from hearing him talk about some of these things, but, and I'm saying that to get to this question is, in light of all this stuff, then they have put out a new Twitter policy. And I guess there was as your story says, the Twitter ban was loosened this month, but it was loosened to allow one pre-approved tweet from players. And I'm sitting there thinking, that actually doesn't look any better. It's like, I'm kind of scratching my head at that. Like that, you know, I could see somebody suggesting that in a meeting as they workshop, and then somebody else going, no, that's kind of going to look like faux transparency, not transparency. What do you make of how they are handling this as it's going? I mean, is it something where there's a lot of input? I mean, we're hearing that some of the past players are going to have input, obviously, in this going forward. But one of those things, I'm like, I don't think they're helping their cause in terms of the listening part of this, and maybe I'm putting too much into it, but I just think that was like a real head scratcher in the face of all this.
Yeah, that really was. It was a surprise to me. First of all, it was a surprise to me on Saturday when it was announced that the social media would be relaxed. And so that really was something that, okay, well, let's look into this. And then I had a couple of parents say, no, that's not. And they have to have everything approved, and they get one, and it has to be submitted by 5 p.m. on Sunday before they can do it. Now, subsequently, some players have either violated that policy, ignored it, or it's been changed. I kind of don't think it's been changed. I think that some of the players are just doing it on their own, where they are doing a lot of retweeting or quote tweeting certain topics. But regardless, I think, you know, when this was implemented, Iowa had an issue, I think it was in 2007 or 2008, where some players on Facebook were posting pictures and memes that now are horrifying, you know, that they're misogynistic at best. And so Iowa really went through this really tight period of, of the tightening up social media. And then Twitter came about. Kirk banned it because he felt it was unfiltered. And at least on Facebook and Instagram, which they are allowed to use, you have to accept people as friends to be able to follow. Well, over the years, they've just continued that ban. And, whether that's been approved by Kirk specifically or Paul Federici, the director of ops, or and put in by Chris Doyle, it's remained in place until now. And then this just is really tone deaf. He discussed it like he was giving them something, like they want to be a part of the conversation now, so we're going to try this. And it's a one-time deal. And that's what he said yesterday. But many of his players have come to him and asked to be back on Twitter. And so it's like a trial period. And again, any tweet has to be submitted for approval. And I just, for a liberal arts institution in Iowa City, Iowa, and if anybody's ever been here knows that doesn't go over very well. But again, over the years, it's just kind of become law to where everybody just kind of rolls their eyes about it. But in this environment, it can't be done anymore. And so I think Kirk is going to have to take another look at this and realize, yeah, we missed on this one. And I think it's tone deaf at best, but it really looks poorly across the board.
So in terms of implications going forward, I mean, you mentioned right off the top, and Bruce and I would surely agree that Chris Doyle's days are numbered. Maybe, you know, they got to do an investigation, but there's no way they can bring him back. There's the question of Brian Ferentz, Kirk's son, which I think has always seemed a little uncomfortable. He technically reports to the AD to avoid that conflict of interest, but You know, on his media call Sunday, Kirk basically said he didn't see the two situations as being similar, and for now seems to be giving his son a pass. But what about Kirk Ferentz himself, the institution, longest tenured coach in the country, you would think seemingly untouchable, and he is himself, as you said, the players are not directly saying that he ever used a racial slur, anything of that nature. But as Kirk himself said, you know, ultimately the buck stops with him, and these are questions that are being raised about the entire way he conducts his program. Quite simply, is his job in jeopardy?
I don't think so. I think he's probably safe at this point. But I think there are some factors that could change that, which one is when this investigation is done or conducted and they find out anything negative about him. I'm not sure that they will. Maybe a few passing things you know, from time to time, but nothing directly. I don't think he's in a problem there. Once they cut ties with Chris Doyle, is that going to be it? I don't know. What if the investigation comes back and says, you know what, we can't have Brian Ferentz as an employee here. Kirk will be 65 in August. Does he decide, you know what, this is just too much for me. I don't want to have any part of this. I can't fire my son. He wanted his son to be the successor, or at least that's what's been implied for all these years. Or other members of his staff. Those are difficult questions, because Kirk has been pretty relaxed and energized about this season. And I'm not so sure he wants to go out this way, but then we've seen a lot of coaches in recent years go out on terms that they probably wouldn't want to be. So I would say probably not at this point, but if something were to affect Brian Ferentz, you know, that I think that could be a possibility.
Scott, I'm not going to pretend to know Kirk Ferentz that well, just from our meetings and time around him a couple times a year, but you've been around him a lot more than certainly I have. What I'm curious about is, just from my hunch on him, is he doesn't strike me as somebody who would want to walk away from this the way it is now, in terms of, I would think, even if some of those things, and even if it includes his son not being part of Iowa football going forward, and obviously that's, it's premature of saying that, but even if it did, he strikes me as the kind of coach who would say, you know what, there's a lot of work left to be done to make this better, and I want to at least help make this transition to a new era, and not just basically walk out the door and have somebody come in and completely start totally anew. Is that probably reading too much into it, or do you think is that in line with your read on him as well?
That's difficult to say. I mean, Kirk is widely respected. I think he's widely respected by just about anybody who knows him. And so that's why, over the years, when there have been mistakes or a lack of success at various times, you haven't seen this outcry that you would for other coaches, frankly, because of the way he conducts his business. And I don't know that he would want to leave on those terms, but I also don't know that he, you know, he's got enough pride in himself that I'm not so sure he'd want to be, you know, for lack of a better term, neutered, you know, in some way. And if he had to fire his son, I'm not so sure that he'd want to be around. I mean, so, you know, I do think he wants to make this a better place, a good place. He's got a lot of energy and endurance, and the players are fucked. You know, in fact, going into this weekend, Iowa had one of its highest, ranked recruiting classes in 15 years. I mean, they're hovering around 11, 13 nationally. That's territory they're never in. So there's a lot of ambition there for him. But, you know, it's really hard to say what happens, you know, beyond Chris Doyle. If it's limited to Chris Doyle and perhaps his son and maybe another coach or two get admonished in some sort of investigation, then I think, you know, you'll see him move forward. But if not, if it's more than that, if there are certain things that get taken out of his hands, I could see him stepping aside. Because I asked him a few years ago when I had a sit down with him, does he, you know, he worked with Bill Snyder and Barry Alvarez and a lot of, and underneath Hayden Fry in the 80s. And I go, do you ever see yourself in Bill Snyder territory age-wise, coach? And he goes, no, there'd be a lot of resistance to that at home. but he's kind of feels like he's in a good position now and doesn't want to leave. But he also told me that he would love it if he could one day just step aside and go coach offensive line somewhere, you know, maybe to D3 or something like that. So I think he's, you know, there's going to be some sort of exit at some point, whether it's this year after this incident or 5 years down the road. I can't predict that, but I do think he is stubborn enough that I think he'd want to fight as long as he could.
It truly is a fascinating situation and one that we need to continue to monitor. It seems to be changing rapidly by the day. Scott, thanks so much for coming on. I know it's been a very hectic few days for you. We appreciate you helping us understand the story better.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right, Stu, one other bit of house cleaning to add here. We just had Scott Docterman on the podcast not long after Scott actually got off with us. There is an amendment to the Twitter policy that we actually talked about per Iowa. While that was the original agreement last week, players are currently on Twitter and do not have restrictions, quote unquote. So an update to their policy that we had just talked about.
The Iowa players have officially been free to send tweets that don't have to be pre-approved and limited per month. So congratulations on Iowa for realizing that it's 2020 in their approach to social media, but obviously it took some outside scrutiny and pressure to make that happen. Back to the podcast in a minute, but first, a word from our newest partner, Hydrant. Top performers in business and sports often attribute their success to their morning routine, whether it's waking up early, setting their goals for the day, exercise, or meditation, but not everyone has the time to do it all. With Hydrant, you can jumpstart your mornings. Hydrant creates flavored electrolyte packets you mix directly into your water to make hydrating your body easy and delicious. And Hydrant is backed by research. The formula was developed by Oxford scientists to provide perfectly balanced, efficient hydration. There's no synthetic colors or artificial sweeteners. The formula is vegan, and you can choose between three different flavors or a variety pack. Hydrant starts at just $1 a packet for a 30-day supply. You can save even more with a monthly subscription. So get 25% off your first order by going to drinkhydrant.com/audible. That's drinkhydrant.com/audible for 25% off your first order. drinkhydrant.com/audible. Now, back to the podcast. We shift to the mailbag segment, Bruce. As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. And this first one from Ronald Simpson continuing on this topic that we've been addressing so far. This situation kind of diffused itself rather quickly, but if you remember last week, it was actually our own colleague, Tashawn Reed, who had been covering Florida State, had recently switched to the Las Vegas Raiders, but talked to Mike Norvell, Florida State's new coach, about how he's been addressing George Floyd and the protests with his team. And he basically said, "Oh, I wanted to make sure I reached out to each of our players individually." And Marvin Wilson, their star defensive tackle, retweeted that and said, "Yeah, that didn't happen. We all just received an auto-generated text," and basically said, "Like, and we're going to walk out. We're not going to practice." And for 12 hours or so, there it was like, "Well, oh my gosh, there's an uprising at Florida State." It ended with him, with Marvin Wilson, putting out a video saying, "You know, we talked it over, and I made my point, and." Mike Norvell told me that he was happy that I used my platform, and we're going to change X, Y, and Z. And it was really, one of those moments where you realize how much power the players are feeling that they have right now. Here's the question. That was all a long way of setting up this question from Ronald Simpson. The Mike Norvell situation reinforces what I, as a black person, figured all along. These coaches don't care about the Black Lives Matter movement. They just want to keep their jobs and not hurt recruiting. Is Jim Harbaugh out there with protesters because he cares or because he has too much to lose by not doing it? Should we care?
You know what? That's certainly a fair criticism to bring up or concern in this. you know, look, there, I think you've seen a spectrum of which coaches have been out there, which have put out statements, which have gone out into protests or marches, and which have really remained silent, or how they've handled it. And I think players are certainly watching. I think recruits' families are probably paying attention to that too. But ultimately, I think to answer Ronald's question, I think if you're somebody there, if the players themselves, especially the African-American players, what do they feel like is sincere? Because they're the ones who are around these guys. They know who really cares about them as people and as men, or maybe just trying to play lip service or do damage control here. And I think that they're the ones who know who's authentic, and they also kind of know where people lie on what matters to them, what conversations have come up. One of the first things I think I did when I got to the Athletic, I ended up having this long Q&A with Chris Peterson. And one of the things that came up in that was him asking about, okay, how do you guys feel about, it was right off the election, how do you feel about the presidential election? And there was comments, and all of a sudden it was like, okay, who in here voted? And he spoke to bigger issues beyond football often. And now, obviously, Chris Peterson's not coaching right now, but I would say there are certain coaches that you know that there's a certain sense of sincerity and authenticity, and there's some others that you're like, okay, some of these things don't add up with what your message has always, you know, been. Are your eyes open to this now? Are you listening in ways that, you know? And I think this is, if it's the case where people, and we saw this happen seemingly in real time with the Drew Brees element of this story on Thursday and Friday, where somebody can be positioned in a certain way, and then it may have been met with a lot of blowback, and then the people they trust and the people that hopefully they care about and trust spoke out about it and spoke to them about it, and it maybe has their attention. And one thing I would kind of add to this before I turn it over to you, Stu, is I saw an interesting interview that Scott Van Pelt had done on one of his sports centers with Dale Earnhardt Jr. And I don't profess to, I don't know hardly anything about NASCAR, so I'm not going to profess to know that I do. But I think anybody who listened to that and listened to the tone in his voice, and there was a sadness, but there was also kind of a realization and an honesty in it. And maybe I'm putting too much into Dale Jr.'s voice, but I thought there was something like, hey, we really need to grow from this. We need to grow from this as people. We need to grow from this as a society. And hopefully there are a lot of coaches, because they have a big platform, they have a huge leadership role, are doing that sincerely and honestly. And to the ones who are only doing it for, if there are those who are only doing it because they feel like it's to keep their jobs or to mitigate some potential recruiting damage, I think their players and the families of those players are going to know about it sooner than later by how they act, because you can't fake it for that long, I don't think.
Yeah, I think for the most part, we in the media aren't really equipped to say, oh, this person's being sincere, this person's not. Certainly a lot of coaches have taken part in these protests with their players. You know, over the weekend I saw Lane Kiffin doing it with Ole Miss. There have been Eli Drinkwitz at Missouri.
Mark Stoops.
Mark Stoops, yeah.
I mean, Mario Cristobal
in Oregon. I will say this for Jim Harbaugh. He has always expressed interest in you know, life matters outside of football. That's why he would bring the team on those spring break trips to places like Italy. You know, he's always seemed interested in making sure the players have a well-rounded education. I wouldn't necessarily say that about all coaches. For the column that I wrote that went up Monday morning about the racial reckoning, as I put it, that's taken place over the last week, I brought up something. You know, I was talking about how a lot of these coaches are so in their bubble, and that's going to have to change. You know, if anything, the last couple of weeks have shown us is that you better pay attention to your players and what they're going through. And do you remember 4 years ago, Nick Saban on Election Day saying he didn't realize it was Election Day, and took some flack at the time, but it wasn't like a huge controversy by any means. So I went back and found that video, and in the and watching it now, I can't believe he said it. The reporter asks him, like, did you vote? Did you, kind of talking about our coaches, what's coaches' obligations when it comes to politics? And he just looks at the guy and he says, he says, I didn't even realize it was election day. And then he says, kind of, dryly and sarcastically, it was so important to me that I didn't even know it was happening. We're focused on other things here. You can't say that in 2020. I mean, you can't say that right now.
I don't think you can say that certainly as a college coach. It's one thing if you're an NFL coach. I'm not saying it's if you're a college coach, I think it looks significantly worse than if you're an NFL coach, to say that.
I mean, just last week, I believe, college basketball coaches basically passed a resolution to let all players have the day off on November 3rd to make sure they go out and vote. This is a very rapidly changing environment. And I do think that players going forward are going to, that there's going to be some backlash or some lack of trust if they don't feel like, exactly the way you put it, if they don't think their coaches are being sincere in their concern for what their players are going through when it comes to a very serious discussion that we're having right now.
Yeah, I just think it comes to, they know, and their families mostly are going to know who's real and who's not real. I mean, they're around them so much more. I think it's one thing for us on social media. It's even one thing, like, again, and I brought this up in our conversation with Scott a bit ago. I have a feel for being around Kirk Ferentz a little bit. I'm not going to pretend like I know what's really in his heart. Just because we spend, maybe an hour in a closed door meeting with him once or twice a year. It's just, that's kind of, you can have feelings on what you think somebody's like, but you really don't know for sure unless you're kind of living with them and living in their world for a long period of time. Next question, Stu, is from Mark in Pennsylvania. Hey, Stu and Bruce, I was surprised in your discussion of Notre Dame and coaching scandals that you never brought up that a student videographer died due to Brian Kelly's decision to host a practice outdoors in dangerously windy weather. He also had numerous incidents where he's shown off an uncontrolled temper. And there was also an academic scandal that claimed two seasons worth of wins. I thought we did talk about the academic scandal there, but maybe
we did.
Urban Meyer definitely has courted controversy as well. But if Notre Dame fans are willing to put up with Brian Kelly's shenanigans, I don't think that they would bat an eye when considering a hire like Meyer, who is a much better coach and program builder.
So he's referencing Declan Sullivan, the student videographer who died. That was Brian Kelly's first year back in 2010. It was awful. And a lot of people at the time and in the years since have stated that they thought Brian Kelly should have been fired over it. And I understand that. I don't think that's the kind of scandal that we were thinking of when he was asking about Urban Meyer. But it was certainly a very serious issue.
Yeah, I think there's definitely it's something that honestly should get noted on that, especially in the light of what we're talking about here. Some of the stuff that Mark also put about, just in terms of the uncontrolled temper, we remember seeing plenty of footage of Brian Kelly red faced on the sideline. When Bo Pelini's name came up, you can see somebody who is like, that is attached to their persona, fair or unfair, that comes with it. I remember, like, I don't know, it was probably 3 or 4 years ago, there was all these stories about Brian Kelly's doing yoga now, he's turned over a new leaf, he's delegating more and all that. I think there is something to be said for coaches who can evolve and grow from where they were. Again, I still hold true, Stu, to the point that I think, because Urban Meyer has been such a successful head coach, that I think a lot of Notre Dame fans, I'm not saying all of them, but I think a whole lot of them, much more than you think, would trade him for Brian Kelly.
Well, after that podcast we recorded, because remember you said you think it'll be over 50% Notre Dame fans, and I said I thought it'd be under. I asked Matt Fortuna, who's covered Notre Dame, who's co-host of the Shamrock podcast, and Pete Sampson has actually written about this, and they both said no, it's over 50% who would take Urban Meyer in a heartbeat. So you were right about that one. But you know what? The fans don't make the hire. And what I do know is that Jack Swarbrick, the AD there, would not, if that opportunity arose, would not feel comfortable hiring Urban Meyer. Whether you agree with that or whether you think you want to liken what Brian Kelly's done or not, I think that I feel, you know, reasonably confident in saying that. Quinn from Bowling Green, Ohio, on last week's mailbag, Stu stated that if you had to pick one team to watch, remember the question was if you could only watch one team for the rest of your life, it would be Ohio State because they're almost always very good to elite with bad seasons few and far between. On the Ohio State State of the Program podcast, Ari Wasserman also mentioned this and then brought up an interesting point. He said that given Ohio State's consistent level of dominance and being in the national hunt, the program has sort of been an underachiever relative to its success. Given that Ohio State has averaged 9.67 wins and 2.57 losses per season since 1971, and it only has two national titles to show for it, it seems like a fair assessment. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's I felt like we stuck our toe in the water on this a little after the draft related to the last 5 years of wildly productive NFL factory kind of stuff. And
yeah,
outside of the...
That question was specific to Urban Meyer's tenure. Should he have won more than one national title? And I think we said yes, that that given all that the elite talent that he had, that there were some squandered opportunities. I would also say that going back to 1971, I don't know. I mean, for a long time there was no national title game. It wasn't the most official way of determining that. Like, I think it's hard to compare eras like that. I mean, they had a team in 1998, I remember very well, that lost one game actually to Nick Saban and Michigan State, was pretty dominant throughout the season. And if there was a four-team playoff, they would have been in it and they probably could have won it. But, you know, that's not the system they had at that time.
Yeah, one thought that came to mind when I did that story on the USC 1979 team that was probably the most talented team ever. So they played Ohio State for the Rose Bowl, and Ohio State was number one coming into that. And so when I worked on that story, I talked to Glenn Mason, obviously Glenn Mason, former Minnesota head coach and now at BTN. And he talked about that team. And, you know, I think a lot of us, and it's not to say that there haven't been great players, because certainly Archie Griffin won two Heismans, and, you know, we remember Chris Spielman and Chris Carter and countless others, but they weren't as loaded. I mean, especially that 79 team, he was like, we were nothing like USC was. And the way he put it, he said, when I was coaching at Iowa State before the game and I'd look at Nebraska's team on the other side, I'd be like, whoa, we got to play these guys. He goes, that's how I felt like when I was at Ohio State when we were playing that USC team. Now, that USC team was a different kind of animal, but I think some of what maybe this is, and again, there's plenty of years where it was Michigan, Ohio State, the big two and the little eight. I get that part of it too. So, but I don't know if it's quite through the same prism as maybe as we're looking at it now in the day in the last like 5 years where Ohio State is just collecting 4- and 5-star guys in ways that nobody else in their conference is. I'm not sure it was quite to that degree at that point.
No, I mean, I think if when you talk about Ohio State's dominance, I mean, they weren't dominant under Earl Bruce. John Cooper definitely had a couple of really good teams in the mid-90s that Michigan screwed up their season. But really, starting with Tressel is when they really started to be a team that would annually win 10, 11, 12 games. And then Urban Meyer, my gosh, 12, 12, 14, 12, 11, 12, 13, 13. The last one being Ryan Day. You know, that's the program that you can, over that time period, say, hey, maybe they should have won more than one during that span. Are they an underachiever from 1971 to 2019? That's harder for me to say.
Stu, this question from Maddie W. in New York. I have a wacky idea that may not be realistic, but is fascinating nonetheless. What if Alabama, given their brand and massive following, decided they wanted to leave the SEC and become an independent, like Notre Dame? They'd sign their own TV deal with CBS, which could replace CBS losing the SEC package. They could still schedule non-conference games annually against LSU, Tennessee, Auburn, and much like Notre Dame, scheduled USC and Michigan on an annual basis, or at least they used to. Wouldn't they generate a lot more money for Alabama, given that they wouldn't have to share TV revenue with schools like Vanderbilt and Missouri, and they could control their own schedule entirely?
No, they would not, is the answer to that question. That you get thrown out a lot. I mean, Texas fans have talked about wanting to go to independent. USC fans, you know, fed up with the Pac-12, want to go independent sometimes. But Notre Dame makes much less money from TV with its NBC deal than whatever it gets from being the road team in the ABC ESPN games. Purdue makes more TV money than Notre Dame does. I mean, any of the Big Ten and SEC schools do. That's the reality of it. There's only so much that one school can get. Now, is it possible Alabama would be considered more valuable today than Notre Dame because it's an annual, you know, national title? They annually play in some of the highest rated games on TV. You know, certainly that's a possibility. But I still think if you're talking solely about money, being part of the SEC, where the networks are paying not just for that one team, but for all of the big games. I mean, last year, LSU played in the highest rated games, although one of them was against Alabama, is more lucrative. You go independent. Notre Dame is independent. We've talked about this many times. Notre Dame is independent for a whole lot of reasons that have nothing to do with TV money. I don't necessarily think that's all that realistic, especially given that Alabama is part of a conference that that they get a lot of exposure just from being in that conference, right? That's a different story to me than USC having to kind of carry a lot of, you know, less known brands in the Pac-12 or even Texas and Oklahoma in the Big 12. The SEC is full of big brand name programs that carry national cachet, and then Alabama benefits from association with it. So creative idea, just probably not as lucrative as some people may assume. So as always, send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. It's been an interesting few months. We never know going into each week what topic's going to end up dominating the conversation on the podcast. We'll see what it is this time next week. We'll see you guys. If you enjoy The Audible, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review and a rating if you could, too. It helps us get the word out. Our producer is John Hayes. Our theme song is Dangerous by Kevin and the Octaves. You can download their music on Spotify or Apple Music. Follow me on Twitter at SL Mandel. Follow Bruce at Bruce Feldman CFB. And if you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, what are you waiting for? TheAthletic.com/TheAudible. That's 40% off your subscription to The Athletic. Come on, get over here. Ah, yeah. Whoa, whoa. Talk about.